Well, Dara, we're 5 hours in. It's been an education. It's been insightful. A really steep learning curve to the background, to the context of the Atlantic salmon. But I feel we'd be remiss not to spend a bit of time on the riverbank now. I think we've deserved it, don't you?
We're not just armchair anglers, yeah.
Well,
at the moment it feels like it.
I certainly am. I haven't cast a line for months. All my fishing is done, sadly, from my armchair. But this man that we're about to talk to is... I don't think he spends any time in his armchair.
When I grow up, I want to be like him. I want to be a salmon angler like this person. Somebody who fishes... He used to fish, I think he was saying, about like 250 days a year. That's probably down to one.
Yeah.
It's probably down to 100 now. If I could get 10% of that, I'd be happy.
If I could get 10 days in, I'd be happy. I know this guy is not all angling heroes wear capes. I know that's a terrible mixed cliche there for you, but where he's lacking a cape, he makes up for in facial hair, in pure fishing, angling authenticity. His skill set, his salmon acumen is off the charts. He's charismatic. He can land a fly to within an inch of where he wants to. He's caught more salmon than I've certainly had hot dinners.
He talks the talk, but he walks the walk. He puts himself out there. And I think he is the 1% of so many of us that, you know, we sit back and go, yeah, fair play to you, well done. Well, he actually is willing to put himself on the line.
There's a lot of anglers out there, public figure anglers, who do a lot of talking, a lot of mugging and a lot of boasting, should we say, but actually are pretty thin in the angling. I know a few. I've worked with a few in my time. But this guy is the antithesis of that. Dara, I'm chomping at the bit to name this guy. Please put me out of my misery.
Mikael Froden. Let's hear from him now.
23 was a difficult year.
Right.
I'm spoiled to fish good rivers and normally end up with a few hundred fish. And I did not last year. I got maybe a quarter of what I normally do. I got some good fish. But it was a difficult season, actually, with fewer fish running. So,
would you say it's worst on record as far as your record goes?
On some rivers, it was okay. It's also depending on the water and conditions. Of course, you can hit a small run with perfect conditions and you do good catches. But it was probably the worst. I've told people that I don't think I caught less salmon since 1984.
Wow.
So that's maybe the answer of that question.
40 years ago. So what is a typical salmon season for you if we take away 2023?
I used to guide a lot, meaning I used to spend a lot of days on rivers besides the fishing too. Now I don't guide that much. I do some classes. We're doing another masterclass now in Norway for the upcoming season, but otherwise I do approximately 14 weeks, and it's in Sweden, Norway, in Scotland, of course, Iceland, Canada sometimes, and we can't go back to Russia now. So I used to do a few weeks in Russia every year, but that's probably gone. I don't think I'm going to be back, unfortunately.
Did I read, Michael, that at one stage you were doing 250 days on the river?
Yeah, many years in a row, actually.
You must have been a young man then.
I was crazy. You know, we have our first, we started our sea trout season on the 1st of January. We used to do back then, and I started fishing. I did opening days on Dal Elv and my home river, an hour from me, 14 years in a row. And I think my coldest opening was minus 32 Celsius, which is, you know, when ice builds on your wading and you can have, it's like a little brick you can put the line on, and it's crazy. I'm getting too old.
Just tell me, because I know, you know, you're technically, as well as everything else, you're someone to ask these kind of questions. I've occasionally had the fortune to fish in that those kind of temperatures, maybe not quite as low, but pretty close over on the west coast of BC and up into Terrace. And the issue we faced there when we're on the steelhead was bringing in the line through the eyes of the rod, and they would freeze instantly. So the guide needed to be sucking on them, literally, to defrost them. I mean, how did you get around that situation?
Never use anything longer than a 10-foot rod, always single-handed. And what you do is that you need to be able to reach the top guide without wading to the bank. So you take you take the ice away, and you take the ice away over there, and don't drop your or dip your reel, because then you're done.
Then you're done, right?
So extremely low temperatures, only single-handed because of the ice. The biggest problem is hooks, because you pick your fly up and you get ice on the hooks, and that's then it's hard to hook them.
What's the fishing like? Have you caught well? Like, have you caught on opening day? Like, how did the salmon react to such extreme temperatures?
At that time of the year, we fish sea trout, and it's mostly fish that'll come up not to spawn, and they're mostly smaller fish. You catch a 6-pounder, you've caught a good fish. But if you've been away from rivers for a couple of months' time, you don't really bother if it's cold,
right,
and icy.
You're just happy to be there.
Yeah, in Ireland, the drows up in Donegal, kind of northwest, is the traditional on January the 1st. And I've fished that once, and you're saying minus 32. I think it was like 5 degrees, and I was like, oh, it's just never again.
I'm scared, wow. You know?
Yeah,
in country.
It's for you. Like, are you down to, you said about kind of 100 days a year you'd be fishing now? Yeah, is it kind of?
About 100 days.
And have you seen, we mentioned in terms of how bad 2023 was, and it seems to have, I've spoken to guides over here, and the words they used was fallen off a cliff.
Mm.
Would you, for where you fished, would you characterize it like that or not as bad?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't dress it like that, because if you go back when I started professionally back in the early 80s, we were complaining then about about the runs were being too small, and I started fighting drift netting early days, and joined up with Ori Wigfusson and the buyouts and all this work, which was fantastic, good step. But I think it's declining every year, and you get every now and then you get a good year when it's been a good situation in the sea with temperatures and food, and fish are coming back in a little bit bigger numbers, but it's steadily going down, and I wouldn't say falling off a cliff. It's like it's been good before. It hasn't been good in my life, even if I'm getting bloody old. The good days were 150 years ago, when ecosystems and stocks were natural and were like the ecosystems wanted this species to be strong, survive, and lots of fish running. That's history, unfortunately.
I want to get into your activism in a short while, Michael, in terms of the work you've done and the awareness you've done and awareness you've raised. And, you know, it's been incredible how much passion and time and effort you've put into it. But I want to bring people back, because it doesn't have to be all doom and gloom, so to speak. You were pretty much a salmon angler from the age of 18. I want to take us back to that in terms of, did you make that conscious decision? Because anybody I've spoken to that ended up as a fly fishing guide or fly fishing lodges, wherever, they kind of fell into it. It wasn't like a career path. But for you, was it just something deep-seated in you that when you were fly fishing and you were fishing for salmon, that you said, this is what I want to spend my life doing?
What's it? You sure? No, I think maybe it was like this. I was a pretty good athlete. I was in the Swedish sailing team, and I decided I've always been fishing, but sailing came to a point where it was almost full time. And at that stage, I was fishing mostly off season or summers where it was not that much competition going on. And then I decided to quit that. And at that stage, I got a little bit of a rumor being a good fisherman. And I got offered a job as a guide on a really, really fancy place in Norway.
Where was that?
That was on the Gaula first. And wow. then we went, I also guided on Driva and Lærdal at that time, and I got I got hooked up with the former president of the Coca-Cola company. Coca-Cola had its fishing in Lærdal, and I worked there, and it was a little ball rolling. And when I decided to, I always tied flies and started to sell flies at an early age, and then it turned out that I decided not to go to follow my parents doing a career or studying universities and this. I decided to postpone that and do the guiding thing, and then I tied flies winter time.
What did your parents say to that, actually, Michael?
I actually get that question quite a lot. My father is a famous transplant surgeon, and my mom is a teacher. They're still alive, both of them. But they actually supported me, and my father supported me big time, saying that follow your heart, do what you want to do. If you want to do something else, there's always time at the later stage. Now maybe it's too late, but and I don't want to change it. So I have to thank them for supporting me, living my dream.
Very progressive parenting there then, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of parents back then, whenever it was...
get a job.
Yeah, get a job. Stop messing around with a fishing rod and go and get a proper job.
And especially in the medical as well. The doctors, I know of parents, you know, it's very much expected the kids follow the medical path. Like,
I had kids to other doctors that I know, because my father was a famous doctor, they put the question to me, say, what do your parents say? I mean, God's sakes, you're only fishing. And they were surprised, and it was obvious their parents would not have supported what my parents supported me. So I'm very grateful for having open-minded parents.
Now, did your parents fish? Because that may have had a bearing on that advice.
Yeah, my father fished, but not in the way I do.
Right, but he got it. He got it.
Fishing a little bit, but I tied my own flies, I didn't borrow my father's rod. I had to buy my first fly rod because there were no fly rods in the family. So
when you were in your 20s then, Michael, did you kind of ditch the sailing altogether and purely focus on the salmon fishing?
Yeah, it turned out when I started guiding, during my sailing, I used to fish winters and early springs before the ice was breaking. And then I fished really late seasons. And then when I started guiding, it turned out to be 3 months in Norway guiding. And then it was almost, then I was on those 250 days of fishing. And I was quite successful. I did good as a guide or a ghillie. And I got in contact with lot of people that influenced me, like Lee Wolf and Stan Bogdan and Schwiebert and Billy Pate and all these my heroes that I've been reading of. I actually could meet them and fish with them and learn from them, and also meeting people that I would never ever have met, even if I'd be choosing another career, people that were really good at something, There were politicians and there were businessmen that were doing good, and a lot of interesting people from Indian Maharajas to Nat Reed, that I fished a lot with. He was a minister under four different presidents, and it's a pretty cool guy. I had lunch with John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. You know, that's a good lunch.
What you did?
Yeah, I met people that gave me also, besides fishing, also gave me a lot of interesting conversations and interesting life.
So what's interesting, what I always find interesting is when I talk, especially when I talk to people like you who've been doing this to such success for such a long period of time, was there a singular event way back when you were a young man that suddenly made you go, this is what I want to do, this is a calling?
There are certain fish you catch. You know, you catch your first Norwegian salmon. I had a fish on an opening day in Norway back in 83, I think, and the papers came because the Swede caught a fish on a fly. Everybody was spinning. Nobody was fishing a fly. And things like that, of course, and catching my first 10-kilo sea trout. And, you know, there's many things like that. But also, I think I'm a very competitive guy. And I'm not trying to compete that much now to others. But at that stage, watching people catch more fish than I did was not the situation I really liked. So how do you do that? I mean, you fish more, and you be more accurate, and you try to put the pieces in this puzzle in the best possible way to be more and more successful. And since this is something you're never going to find that last puzzle piece of to the puzzle. It's been just going on. It's you every season you crack a little code here, and you say, oh, okay, I used that situation there, that fly doing this, and I caught a few fish, and here we go again, and it worked again. And, you know, it's an ever
evolving.
Yeah, it's developing all the time, and it's doing that to a personal, for me, that it makes me feel good.
Actually, interesting just there, you mentioned, Michael, like, would most people have been spinning?
Yeah.
Like, we take it for granted now in terms of fly fishing.
It sounds like you said the Swedish brought in the, you know, the fly angle, as it were, to the Norwegians on that, especially on that opening day in 1983. Was that a thing? Were the Swedish more progressive when it came to fly fishing?
More civilized, I think, too.
Yeah, I think so.
We had a big difference. Swedes are always better than Norwegians. But we have this little thing going. But no, but it was a situation here where we had a tradition of fishing early spring in the very cold water. And we were good at that. So for us to come over to the Norwegian River in the beginning of the season, a sinking line, a heavy sinking line, and the techniques to fish that was something that we were used to. Mm. Norwegians were not. They don't have a tradition where they start fishing early spring. They start 1st of June.
Yeah.
And for us, 1st of June was not really early, even if you could fish down to 2 or 3 degrees Celsius in the water. It was something we've done a lot, and that's why I think with what you call Scandinavian style, maybe I've been having a part in developing this, and it's more Swedish than Norwegian, actually, because of the tradition we have. And it's the same now. All Norwegian rivers are closed. If you want to fish in Sweden now in November, you can go to certain rivers and you can fish for sea trout running the river late, not coming up to spawn, but you'll find fantastic fish in the cold waters. And we have almost a year around here. And I think that's why we had a knowledge that that most Norwegians didn't.
So basically, when in the future, when everyone lumps Scandinavia in together as being the way they are with their fly fishing being exceptionally good and having that particular style, let's not do that. Let's say it was the Swedish who had it first.
You know,
and then it infused into the Norwegians.
Me if I say that, but I think
we true.
But it's true. We can say it.
Group of Swedes. We were a small group of Swedes actually started working in Norway from at the beginning of June, back in the early 80s, with techniques that were not common there. And then we built on that and developed equipment around that. And of course, there were quite a few Norwegians that picked up early and was part of building this. Also Danish guys, and the Finnish tradition is a little different, I would say, but they were, it was, if you're a fly fisherman at heart, if you're really crazy about it like I am, you will not grab a spinning rod just because it's cold.
Yeah.
I've actually never caught a salmon on a spinning rod, and
have you not in all your time?
No,
that's never. That's cool.
Actually, sorry, can I just follow up on there? One quick question for you, Michael. Why did the Norwegians not fish year round compared to Sweden? Was it to do with climate? Was it to do with the rivers frozen?
It was a tradition that we were fishing for sea trout in rivers early, and I think that that tradition was not in Norway. You know, early season, like February, March, April, we have sea trout running rivers, not for spawning, but they will come up and they will run up, and they are fantastic fish. And you find them among the Celts. And when it comes to sea trout, you know, they're eating in the river. They're not like salmon Celts. You'll get Celts, I mean, fish that actually spawn in October that are in pretty good shape in March, depending on river they've been living in. But that's not what we were aiming for. We were aiming for these cromers that were coming up early spring. And that tradition was not in Norway, and it still isn't. I'm sure that you take some of the best Norwegian sea trout rivers, there are fantastic trout running rivers in March and April, but the rivers are still closed.
You've fished so much. You've been so lucky and deservedly so. Give us some of your highlights. Go on, make us salivate, make us jealous. Give us some of your highlights over the years.
I don't know. The best of the big fish. I had a fish in Lietza in Russia a few years back. It was, 42 pounds. Full of sea lice, male, fantastic. I was by myself, and that was a pretty cool fish to catch. I've been having days when you catch at 30 in the morning and at 30 at night, and next morning you think, oh, that was a fantastic day, and you go out and you catch another 30 pounder. And you know, we shot a film. This is many years ago in the ASR in Russia. The fishing was just fantastic, and I had a camera team with me, meaning you put half the amount of hours fishing than you do. But I ended up by restricting myself to 10 fish a day, and ended up catching I think it was 22. Salmon over 20 pounds in a week. That's a pretty good. I think I was on 55 fish totally. And, you know, that's...
Wow.
You know, I've been on the Alta when it's good, and you walk down the pool and you catch a fish, and you do that five times and you catch five fish over 20 pounds. And
I mean, a lot of people would have hung up their rod after that. I'm not sure I would have, but a lot would have, because you can't, you know, once you've caught 20 to 50 fish in a day, and a lot of them are over 20, 30 pounds. It doesn't get better than that if it's about numbers and size and that kind of thing. But
it is, that's the key. It's not
about that, exactly.
Yes, I've caught 5-pound fish that would have given me exactly the same thrill. It's just that you come into a situation where people say it's impossible, and you know the fish are there, and you adopt your techniques, and you catch a fish. So it's not about that. I was going to say, you asked me about special fish. I hooked a big fish on the Alta. It's probably the biggest salmon I've ever hooked. Played it for 40 minutes or something, never saw it. I'm not sure it actually knew I was there, but I'm known to fight them hard. But this was just too big fish to be caught. And things like that never, you know, you live, you have salmon fishing as your life. That's on my mind.
It sounds like, and it's a really, it seems like a universal answer, actually. It's about the challenge, isn't it? It's not about the big fish. It's not about numbers of fish. The best fish are the ones that are the most challenging fish. And as you said, when somebody says there are no fish here, or there are some fish holding in that pool, but they're not takers. If you can catch one of those fish and surmount that challenge, then that is a really special catch.
And also you get into a situation where you're on a river and you get into really good flow where you, and I don't mean only catching fish, but you are feeling good. Your weighting is good.
Your casting's well, yeah.
Your casting is well. You pick the right fly. You do what you try to do. You succeed in doing what you try to do. You catch a few fish.
Yeah.
Hot beer, you be in the grass, the sun is up there. I mean, it's a mental stage that is pretty hard to beat, actually.
Michael, what would you say is the biggest mistake you see salmon anglers make?
The biggest mistake is they don't fish a straight line. I normally say like this, doing my classes and things, trying to make people catch more fish, is that if you imagine, I think that maybe 70% of the fish I catch will pick up the fly and know the fly is there immediately when it lands, and they will either take it directly or follow in and take it. Okay, if you cast your line out and you think, okay, you're casting a little longer than you actually can, which is a mistake, and you don't get your line to be straight on the water, meaning you have 3 or 4 meters of line that will have to stretch out, that will take about 30% of your drift before it's actually straight. I've been so many times on a bridge looking and you have 1.5 meter of leader that's not straight and you think, the current will straighten it out. It takes a long time. So you do a little calculation here and say, okay, so 70% of the fish will pick up the fly on the first 30% of the drift. And the first 30% of the drift, the fly is not fishing. You're going to catch less fish. My little class I do is called the perfect drift, meaning it's all about, I don't think it's much hocus pocus, actually. Try to get as much perfect drift as possible. The more meters of perfect drift you're going to be able to produce, the more fish you're going to catch. So biggest mistake, cast a little shorter, or make sure to straighten that line to get this first piece of the drift.
Presentation then is absolutely key, and a lot of, it sounds like what you're, well, certainly how I interpret some of that, that's great advice, by the way, is a lot of people tend to what I call overcast, which is you know, they'll go for distance because they not just because it feels great to hurl out a long line, but also because they feel it's going to give them a bigger and a longer drift, when actually the more line that you're dealing with, the less likely you're going to get it straight in that 30% window. Is that right?
Absolutely. And the slower the fly will fish. And I think we, 90% of the time, fish too slow. Salmon is a predator. I mean, if they say that, oh, it came when missed my fly. If salmon will miss a fly, they would starve to death. It's easy for them to take if they want it. And when they come up and splash on it or pull it or whatever, it's a lot of the times I think it's because it's too slow.
Okay, so that's interesting. And you know, at the risk of laboring the talk of technique, because I could talk all day, as I'm sure we all can, about improving our chances of catching one. You know, when you're faced with a non-taking salmon or a hesitant salmon or a resident fish or whatever you want to call it, how much of your time do you spend covering that fish and changing your fly and changing the drift before you move on and go, okay, that fish isn't for me?
It depends, but I think it's easy to say like this, that a salmon is really easy to spook to start with. If you spook a salmon, they're not like trout. They're not leaving the pool. But they will be very much harder to make them take. So first of all, try not to spook the fish. And then I would say that they have they're easy to get bored. If you keep on casting these flies over the fish, they get bored. And they're not going to take it most of the time. But they have very short memory. So it's much better to fish that fish a couple of times, maybe different size or the depth and speed, of course, and then rest it and go back. And I normally say that most salmon, or I would say all salmon, can be caught. But the window of when the fish actually will take the fly can be really short. Mm. And if you fish outside that window, you can fish that fish a million times. It's not going to take it. You need to present the right fly on the perfect drift during that little window.
Yeah.
And you have a fresh fish coming in, just in shallow water on a slick tail out. Perfect temperature, they grab almost everything.
Yeah.
And their window is so big, they will take 24/7. But that's not the case most of the time. You have to find that window.
So do you think then, if we're talking about windows, it's a great analogy, we're not talking about those fresh chromas that are ready and willing to take anything that moves, and as you know, the majority of fish aren't those. Can we expand that window, or are we completely at the mercy of the fish and its instinct there? Or can we go, okay, there's a small window here when you're on, let's just try and manipulate it to a bit of, you know, give us more time to catch you. Is there a way we can do that, or is that up to the fish?
I think if you look at the window to try to I love this, by the way, because I love to just try to divide things into what we know and what we don't know. Try to make as much facts as possible. I talk in my writing, I talked about truth and salmon truth. They are not really true, but who knows? But I think this window is not a black and white thing. There are a window when the fish will take almost everything, or if you do it right. But I think you can increase the size of the window by doing right, and I think that maybe the best way to increase the window is to fish a smaller fly, faster speed. I think inside the window they will take almost everything, doing almost right. But if you do it a little bit more right, you can increase this wind. And most of the season, if you have a fish that's not been in the river for months on really warm water, that window is almost there all the time. But you have to adjust to it. You if it's tricky, you go down in size and you speed up the fly. Don't give him too much time to look at what's coming and think, should or shouldn't I? I mean, either grab it or you don't. And you know, it's. But I think if this was all only up to salmon, that we need to find the fish, the right fish at the right time, it would not have been interesting. I would not have done this a lifetime. But if I can actually be skilled enough to move that window and to be able to do the impossible.
There's that challenge that you love, right?
And that's why we love it, isn't it? The fly fishing, you know, we're not as good as you, Michael, about it, but like that's why we all approach it. You know, it's that puzzle, it's that problem. I nearly do the whole episode just on this. Michael is talking about how to catch salmon. Maybe that's for another time. but maybe I just want to bring it onto your activism, because that's been a huge part of your life, your career, your fishing, your fly fishing. Was it the 1980s when you mentioned kind of the drift netting? Was that when you first started getting interested and involved in that side of it with the activism?
You know, if you want to catch a lot of fish, you want to have a lot of fish in the river. So I think it was just egoistic. I wanted more fish in the river, so I was fishing to catch more fish. But I think when I started to spend as many days on rivers, and you could see how wrong a lot of the things were. I mean, you have a river with the fjord full of traps, and you realize that only a small percentage of the fish will manage to run the river. Of course, you want to take those away, and then when you start being interested in counting par and all this, and you can see that the potential of the rivers is only used to a very small percentage, then you will start thinking what can we do about it. And I think it also, for me, in a way, making myself a name in the business, where people were listening when I was talking about what we just talked about on how to present the fly, I had an audience so that I could actually present a much more important message to, that we need to take care of the stocks and the wild fish. Otherwise, it's going the wrong way. It's been part of me ever since the 80s, I would say. And it's also giving back. I mean, I'm 62 years old. I spent most of my life on salmon rivers around the world. And it's for me to try to do something good and give back to salmon and fishing that's given me such a good life, you know?
You know, your activism starting 40 years ago, which is incredible, really, that you've been fighting for the wild fish for that long. And you told us that being a respected angler that you are, that was your that gave you the platform for people to listen to you. Did you ever find it challenging, especially in those early days, for people to take you seriously talking about conservation, nature, perhaps things that they might perceive were beyond your wheelhouse as an angler?
I actually almost been banned on a few of the rivers. Started talking about catch and release back in a time where everybody killed everything, and on the Murrum, for example, I started releasing my fish, and I realized that people wanted to kill the fish not because they wanted to eat that old salmon male in September, but they wanted to find their name in the record book. So I started. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but we are pretty primitive creatures, and
it was tradition, right? It was tradition as much as anything else.
Yeah. But I started to releasing the fish and putting them in the record book, which was not allowed. So every morning they came down with the tippex, and they tippex my catches away. And it's not that too long ago, I actually went back in these record books and looked at this. And this, they really did not like what I did. They thought they needed the catch to the catch records to show how good the fishing was and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was all, that was tricky. And also when they had hatcheries on the same river and also other rivers where I've been actually fighting hatcheries for a long time, to my knowledge, hatcheries is genetic pollution. And people say to me, oh, okay, but we take fish from this river and we put them out in the same river. But that does not, it's interfering with nature in a negative way. Most rivers have at least three or four different genetic codes on the salmon, some coming early, some running far up the systems. And when we start taking out fish, first of all, we take out the wild fish that would have spawned. And then we put them in a hatchery, and the only thing we can be sure of is that these fish would not have chosen each other on the in the river. That's for sure.
An arranged marriage. And
we're also taking out a lot of resources to build a hatchery that could have been put in a way to support nature. And to restore what man has made wrong. So and this also almost got me banned on a few rivers. So it's not only commercial interests. It's also a fisherman that needs to actually realize that we need to think about wild and support ecosystems. I think.
But isn't that why you need the pioneers, isn't it? Like yourself, you know, people who are willing to kind of put your head above the parapet. You know, you're the ones that kind of get shot at in the early days. But if you can eventually bring the other people behind with you over time.
I have people now. There's a big discussion in the UK about hatcheries, and there's a lot of people being pro-hatcheries because there's so few fish. What should we do? And I try to explain that. If there is a lot of fish in a wild fish in a river, a hatchery doesn't do any damage because the wild fish is so much stronger. But if you have very few fish and you put on a hatchery, you're going to have a bigger impact with the hatchery and you're going to do much more damage. So, and I guess there are people in the UK today that think that I should shut up, But hatcheries is no way, to my knowledge, the right way to go to support wild fish. It's something completely different.
I'm very interested in this topic, and you're absolutely right. It's very prevalent and very current at the moment in debate for Scottish rivers. And I guess the basic debate is that you've so brilliantly presented is that Do we play God now and do we intervene and do we create a hatchery in a river that is so that the wild stock is so low that we need to intervene and get the brood stock that still potentially have that strong wild DNA before it's too late, or the counter would be, which I'm guessing is what you're supporting, but I'd love to hear is you just leave that river, so any of the rivers in question now where the wild stock are so depleted, obviously they're very well monitored and getting increasingly monitored, better monitored every year. Would you leave that river and hope that not over 1 or 5 or even 10 years, but maybe over the next 20 years, and this is on the huge assumption that we don't keep destroying the ecosystems provided that are necessary for the wild fish to thrive, would you say that they will come back on their own accord?
Evolution is a fantastic thing, right? But it takes a bit of time. You know, if a salmon stock will go extinct, it will come back natural way, because one way of supporting the wild stock is that there are a small amount of fish that will run the wrong river. And naturally, these rivers, if you say that they will be totally empty, they will come back. Evolution will make sure it comes back. But one thing is for sure, if we put the hatchery on, we will destroy evolution. We will interfere in a way that the ecosystem did not meant us to do. But when you say leave a river, I don't agree with that at all. We shouldn't leave any rivers. We should fight for every river and every wild fish. And as long as there are so many obvious reasons that these rivers are declining, as long as there are obvious things we need to fight against, that's where we should put the effort, not in building a hatchery or to fight each other about if it's good or bad. It's pretty obvious today. The biggest threat to all wild salmon is fish farming.
Michael, and you mentioned fish farming there. And do you see that as the number one threat to...
By far.
Tell us... Because again, we're going to be covering this in terms of the growth and the development of the industry in Norway and how it's affecting Iceland. So we're going to be getting into that in this series. But for you as a salmon angler, when did you first kind of realize, because in fairness, I don't know if you agree with me on this or not, but when fish farming first came along, people thought, look, this is an answer.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is cheap food. This is how, you know, this is, we can do it. This is great.
Yeah. I was there.
Yeah.
I was there too.
So when did you first kind of start changing and realizing, no, this is not...
I think it was on the West End, Norwegian West Coast, when fishing, we realized that we got many small sea trout that were covered in sea lice. And they had so many, you know, you look at back in the good old days, we looked at sea lice as being something good. It was a sign the fish was fresh from the sea and so on. There were many sea lice, and there were sea lice larvae, and it was kind of obvious these sea trout were actually escaping the sea to get rid of the sea lice. And it was easy to see that this was no good. And we got fish that was partly eaten by sea lice. And then you had to listen to the scientists, and got the knowledge that just a dozen sea lice will kill the smolt when they leave. And this was maybe 15 years ago or 20 years ago that I changed from thinking that the fish farming industry was going to save our wild fish from being eaten and fished commercially, that fish farming being the biggest threat. And also on some of the small West Coast rivers of Norway, we were getting odd-looking fish, meaning escapees. And if you have a river where there is only a few hundred fish running and suddenly you get 100 fish with a different DNA, you didn't have to be very smart to realize that this was genetic pollution. And I was actually one of them that was fighting to get the genetic status on the Norwegian rivers. So we got that first time, I think, 2017. That showed that about 60% of all the Norwegian rivers were affected in the DNA by fish farming. So the problem was actually even bigger than I thought. And even rivers like the Alta, that's reckoned to be the best big fish salmon river in the world, was affected. And there were, if I remember the figures now, there were 30% that was heavily affected. And in the first study, and 15% the scientists said that they were affected so much that they were lost. And this is now, what is it? It's soon 10 years ago. And these figures is going up and up, and now the rivers that are lost are on about 30%. And to my knowledge, it's like this: fish farming is increasing. The problems is increasing. They say they don't have as big problems, but the problems is bigger and bigger and bigger. And they don't want the fish to escape, but there's still more fish escaping than wild fish entering the rivers in total.
And absolutely, it's categorically proved now, isn't it, factually, that the escapees are certainly damaging and really compromising the wild stock to great effect. In the same breath, if we're to believe the evolution theory, which of course I think we all do, would, as long as we stem the escapee issue and hopefully stop it completely, wouldn't the already let's call them hybrid fish, the fish that have had escapee DNA interbred with them, would then they be phased out through evolution of the wild fish, do you think? Do you think they'd come back?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a strong believer in nature, and it's taken evolution hundreds of thousands of years to create just this species to run this specific river. And this fish farming has changed this in just a couple of decades. It's really scary. But I think every time that we get, nature gets a chance to recover, it recovers faster than we think.
Yeah, thank God.
Fish are coming back much faster. Their DNA is the strong wild fish is taking over, and it will repair. And I think if we take away the whole fish farming industry, I know it's utopia, we're not going to do it, but let's say we take it away. I think you look in, you go two decades from now, and it will be repaired. And the stocks will be, there will be good stocks in all salmon rivers. And if we don't do it, I'm a positive guy. You need to be a positive guy to be a salmon fisherman. But I'm afraid if we let fish farming, open pen fish farming, keep on doing what they do, I think we have two more decades, then all wild fish will be gone.
And of course, to more than exacerbate that, there's the dreaded climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it affects, of course, and you can see that in certain areas it's affecting faster, and probably without the fish farming industry, the Atlantic salmon populations will move and be stronger in other areas maybe than today. And we have the change on the Gulf Stream that will affect the Norwegian fishing, I think, a lot. Now they say that maybe the Gulf Stream will collapse within 2 years' time. That will have a tremendous effect. And again, it's man, I think what we can do, actually, and what I've been trying to help doing, is to get the fish farming into close containments. And if we can do that, that's one good step. But also, since I'm on the Swedish East Coast to the Baltic, I see the problems we have in the Baltic Sea. There's no herring. The herring is almost extinct from trolling, and the trawlers been overfishing, and the big commercial trawlers. And what are they trawling for? They're trawling for food and proteins to the fish farming industry.
Which is crazy. A lot of people don't know that, right? A lot of people don't know that. Yeah, I think it's a 4-to-1 ratio, isn't it? The wild fish from all around the world now is being made into fish meal to feed aquaculture, rather than to feed directly people, either the poor who can't normally, you know, who could afford that protein if it was direct from the herring and the anchovy and all the processed fish that goes into fish meal, but it's just a crazy unsustainable system, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was on a very interesting talk some time back. It was a girl talked about where we are in the food chain, and we're actually eating too high up in the food chain, which is a really interesting way of looking at it, into things. If we'll eat further down in the food chain, it will be much more sustainable for us. And it will be much better also for the smaller fish to have the predators. And again, we're on the ecosystem and how it works and how complex it is.
Yeah, absolutely. But just going back to climate change, it's interesting that the fish, I think, will adapt and move maybe further north and follow the food and follow the cold, clean water. If it continues at the rate that it's doing, where do you see the salmon, the wild salmon stock moving to in numbers?
Again, I think that climate change is probably the biggest threat we have for the planet, but I don't think it's the biggest threat for our wild salmon stock. So I think that's fish farming. You know, fish farming is hard to change and to do something about, but it's much easier for us to fight that and to fight climate change for sure. So if we want to have impact in securing wild stocks of salmon, I think as an angler or the angling community, which we can do is actually fight the open pen fish farms and try to affect politicians and people around it to speed up the change where we get it into close containments. That's going to take away the genetic pollution and the sea lice problem. Then they will need to solve the food problem. 70% soy today, I understand.
Michael, it's really interesting because I think I remember the story you told before, and you talk about, you know, how can people make an actual change and make an impact? And you tell the story about, is it when you go to a restaurant or a supermarket, you ask to see the salmon? And you highlight and you try and educate the people there in the shop, in the restaurant, going, no, do you know what this salmon is about? And I think something as simple as that
makes a big difference.
Yeah, like I don't, I refuse now to buy or eat farm salmon anymore. And what it was actually was from the kids. The more I was reading up about it in terms of what went into this fish and into this food, I couldn't in my right mind give it to my kids. And I would love an alternative. Give me the fish alternative. Give me something there that I know is healthy. But there's no way I can put this into my kids. And is this something you still keep doing in terms of when you go into a restaurant or a supermarket?
Not only restaurants. I actually do it where every time I walk into a food store. And now they're in my local food store, they're sick and tired of me asking these questions. But I actually had a thing happening a couple of years back. Maybe that's what you refer to. But I was popping this question in enough amount of food stores and doing my little preach about how poisonous this is and how much damage it does to nature. And I was going to a place where I haven't been, and I asked for salmon at this fish counter, and the lady showed me over to this pile of ugly looking farmed fish. And I said, no, I want real salmon. And she looked at me and said, hey, you that fishing guy, huh? And that, I'm in a town with 300,000 people. And to me, that, you know, it was good, but it also shows that as an individual, you can make a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, she's been talking probably with her buyer or someone else probably where they were buying their fish and saying, this is this guy saying this is poisonous. But you can make a difference as an individual. First of all, don't eat it. And I wrote an article in Chasing Silver magazine a few issues back where I actually was putting my head out a bit and blaming the the fishing community be hypocrites and sitting on the bench by the river and complaining about situation, and then they go and have their sushi lunch and support the industry. And what we can do is first stop eating this, and then we can pop the question, and we can when we're invited to our dinner at our neighbors and they serve salmon, we could not eat it and say it's bad, we should not eat it, and just keep on preaching how bad this is for health and for the for nature ecosystem.
Talk to us about artificial, in terms of, because I think again the awareness that was raised by that, and actually it was the consequences of them taking you to court and prosecuting it, that was actually nearly tenfold in terms of the publicity.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of interviews like this for fishing mags or whatever, but that this being accused for trespassing, because the laws say that you cannot get any further than 20 meters from an open pen. And it was actually on my social medias where people could see I was on the pen and stating that no mom in the whole world would feed the kids. You've seen this with what's in here. So important here is education. We have to educate the public on what's going on and what they are actually feeding us with. But then I was accused and I was taken to trial. And Patagonia backed me really well in this, the artificial is Patagonia film, but also telling me, you want the fight, we back you all the way, which was really good. Without them, I wouldn't been able to do it the same way. But I did, in about 6 months, I did 180 interviews, and it was Guardian, it was BBC, New York Times, CBS, all these big medias that will normally not listen to a bold 60-year-old fly tyer from Sweden. But I got a really good chance here to actually get it out. And it was hard work. And I think actually we did some good, because there was a couple of years later, there was an interview in our biggest financial paper in Sweden with the CEO of a company that are putting in 3 billion kroner into a farming, a closed containment farming on land in Sweden. They were going to produce 20% of what Swedes consummate of salmon. And she said in that interview that it was all this fuss that was caused by artificial and my trial that made them see that here we have a big industry that's making a lot of money that will probably have to change.
It works.
Yeah. It works. It does work. I mean, and we just have to fight it. The worst thing we can do is sit back and say, hey, this is not... there's no salmon running. What should we do? We better put a hatchery on the river. And it's ridiculous. We need to fight the problems. And we know what the problem is. It's not just me thinking. It's the whole scientific community knows that the problem is fish farming.
So activism and spreading awareness and, as my wife calls us, being a fish bore, we need to keep doing these things. We need to keep banging people over the head until they see what's going on out in these fish farms. And it does make a difference. It's really interesting listening to your story about artificial there. Thanks for that. So as a call to action for listeners, Michael, if you had €1 billion or equivalent to change the course of the plight of the Atlantic salmon, what would you do?
I would have to say you need to have a bigger wallet. €1 billion is a lot of money. But remember, we're fighting an industry that makes $1 billion profit per day. Okay? If I had a billion, I'd probably, will I do with a billion? You can buy a few of these companies, but I don't think that will be the most efficient way. I think I would try to get 10,000 people to do what Alexandra Morton and with Corin Smith, myself, and a few others done, is to get into the farms, film it, educate the public, get people to know how dirty this industry is. I think education and to get activists that actually don't give a shit about the rules and the laws, but to care about the ecosystems and the fish. If we can, if I'd had a billion, I'd give them enough money to make as much fuss as possible. I think that must be one way of doing
it. So you see disruption as a really valid and worthwhile thing, which I'm sure it is. It certainly has its place, and it sounds like more documentation and reporting on what the visuals of what fish farms are and how grotesque they can look and what damage they're doing. You think there's nothing stronger, perhaps more impactful than seeing those images firsthand.
And you look at who's done best. Alexandra Morton's work in the US and Canada is fantastic. And what Corin's been doing in the UK has been really, really good. If they had a little more resources, and me too, maybe to spread this message more, because the scientists are with us, the photos and the filming are there. I think this is what affects people. We had the films from artificial scent in quite a few news channels, and here in Sweden, it was a big problem. One of my sons worked in a food store, and he said that everyone that walked over to the fish counter asked, was this what I saw on the news yesterday? I don't want to have that. Is there something else?
You think those images and that documentation probably the most powerful piece or weapon in our arsenal against fish farms?
I believe in the power of the consumer. People, they are in many ways egoistic, and people don't want to hurt themselves or their kids. So if we can educate, this is no good. And people don't want to do bad things. In general, if we know that we walk over to the food store and we buy and support this industry, we're actually doing something that is really bad for us, for our kids, for nature and for salmon, and for it's not good in any ways.
Do you think though, like, it's really interesting when you see what's happening in Iceland in terms of the power of the populist movement there, that it seems to be a bit of a tipping point? And, you'd wonder if what's happening in Iceland, you know, will you start to see that kind of spread to other countries? It can be done.
Yeah, we took an artificial to Iceland and had the opening in artificial in Iceland. Had a lot of journalists traveled, and we went to the Westfjords and looked at what was going on there, showed the journalists how fish farming works. Actually, when I came up to Westfjords, the police were there waiting for me and asked Fredin, what are you doing here? Are you going to cause some problems? It was pretty good to have the police there in front of all the journalists. Yeah, but anyway, what they're doing in Iceland, Iceland is a small community. There are only 300,000 people. Half of them live in Reykjavik. I was going to say that to be a politician in Iceland, you know almost all of the people that vote for you. So it's the system is a bit closer, and maybe it's easier, but there's still increasing fish farming in Iceland. But to throw a few fish in front of Parliament, it's fantastic.
1% of the country turned up for that protest, you know. That's insane.
Yeah, fantastic.
So now that you've done the what you would do with it with $1 billion, Michael, let's bring it back down to earth. We don't all have $1 billion. What can someone listening to this do? A singular person listening to this, how can they make a difference to help save our Atlantic salmon?
Well, what we have to do is that we have to question the industry, and we have to first, like I said, stop eating the fish. That's number one. If you just have one meal of farmed salmon, open pen farmed salmon, you are actually supporting their business. What we can do is that we can ask for close containment salmon, farmed salmon in our food store, in our restaurants, and we can get awareness about the difference between open pen and close containment farmed fish. We can help doing that by talking to everyone, you know. It's quite simple. And if we're 1 million people doing it, we can tell another 10 million and we get another 100,000 hooked up, and we can get a ball rolling here. And it's very important, I think, that now when close containment are starting to be commercial in a way that is actually an option to buy it, we can support them by buying their products. And I actually think that we will, in the fishing community, have problems changing the open pen fish farming industry. But I think that the closed containment fish farming industry, they will be powerful enough to maybe change the industry. They want to make the money, okay?
Their margins are a lot thinner though, aren't they? And actually, a lot of those closed containment pens, if you scratch the surface, are owned by the open pen companies. But you're absolutely right. So it sounds like, if I can just reflect on what you've said, and I think it's great advice, you would encourage people to have that conversation. It sounds like aquaculture is your thing, and that's where you want to pin. That's where you want to pin it on your mast, that aquaculture is the big issue and the big challenge facing the wild stock. And to help with that cause, you want to encourage people to have the conversation, and you want to encourage them that if they still want to continue to eat Atlantic salmon, which we all know is all pretty much all farmed, then you know, lobby for closed containment pen farms.
What I'm doing now, since I have friends that are in the restaurant business and on a fairly high or important position, so we try now to educate the best chefs that what they are serving is not a it's first of all not good food, but it's affecting what we do in a bad way. So we try to get done here in Sweden what's been done in Iceland, where you have the little sticker on the restaurant saying we don't serve open pen fish farm salmon. We tried to get that done in Sweden with some of the chefs that have Michelin restaurants, and you get these guys aboard,
you can affect change. Yeah. Yep, I mean, definitely. It's a shame in the UK we have some very influential chefs, as I'm sure you're aware, the likes of Gordon Ramsay, to name but one, who are still, for whatever reason, not flying this flag. Hopefully, it's only through ignorance as opposed to anything more by design, should we say. So I think you're absolutely right. If you get these influential and powerful chefs on board, you really are going to affect the change in a much more expedient way. Final question, just to bring it up to a lighter note again. If it was your last day on Earth, Michael, what river would you fish?
What dam will I blow up?
No, you've done your activism. You've saved the world.
Relax now. You can chillax now.
You can relax. The fish farms are all closed. They're all on land. There's no hatcheries, and you have a choice. Your reward, shall I say, for all this wonderful work that you've done in saving the salmon is that you're allowed to choose any river on Earth. Where would you fish and who would you take?
And there's no war.
There's no war. Yeah, Russia's open.
What would I choose? So would I go to a new river that I want to fish? I haven't fished. I think I'd go to either the Eastern Litsa in Russia or to the Alta. And I will bring my kids. And both my kids caught their salmon on a fly. Jakob, my youngest, is part of the company, and he's an avid fisherman. And I bring those. And I'll probably bring my old dad. He's been with me summer fishing a couple of times.
He's still around, is he? That's great.
Yeah, it's 19 February. And
he's still fishing?
He's not really fishing, but his body is older than his head. I can say it like that.
Right.
And then I bring Bob Dylan. I bring Bob Dylan to form the words that will help us change things in a good way. And I'll bring Elon Musk to finance the whole bloody thing.
Would you want Elon Musk on the banks with you? I don't know.
I want his money to finance what we do.
Maybe you can persuade him to give you the money, but you don't want him there on the riverbank. Maybe you do. I'm not sure.
He might be good at making coffee. Who knows?
Michael, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. You've lived a life that has been so full. You've followed your passion, your career. Do you regret in the sense of that activism has had to take over so much of your life?
No, I should have started way earlier. If we started fighting fish farming 20 years before we did, we would have had a bigger chance. And we cannot give up. We just need to put more and more of a time into this and not leave it to our kids, because otherwise both my kids been catching their salmon, and like things are going now, they will not be able to do the same with their kids, which is pretty scary.
So it's a big responsibility that you feel heavy on your shoulders.
I used to say that you, as a father, you need to introduce your kids and learn them what's important in life, like catching an Atlantic salmon on a fly. But the fight, we fight for them. They need to fight for their kids, and we need to put effort in what we believe in and try to be truth to ourselves. And
I mean, listening to you, Michael, both as an activist, as a fantastic activist that you are, and obviously an exemplary angler, you are a really great role model and a fantastic figurehead, I think, when it comes to the next generation. And for that, I take my hat off to you, and you're a real inspiration. So please, please keep doing what you're doing, because it certainly inspires the likes of me and many, many others. So thank you from the bottom of our heart, and keep fighting the fight, man. It's great and very, very important.
Thank you for those kind words. I promise that I'll never stop fighting.
Coming up in the next episode of The Last Salmon,
we'll be talking to a titan of industry, also a titan of conservation. This man sits on the top of the mountain. He is a mighty oak. He is the founder of Patagonia. He is none other than Yvon Chouinard.
I decided to do it my own way. Life is a lot easier by breaking the rules than trying to conform to them. It's a lot easier. You can invent your own games, and you can always be a winner. But if you have to play someone else's game, they're going to win.
Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to give us your feedback, rate, and review. We want to open up the salmon discussion to you.
And remember to keep in the fight for our salmon.